What's the context of modern missions? That's the question with which we're dealing. And as we continue our study of the context of modern missions, we need to be keenly aware of the demographic explosion which is taking place in the world today. Back in the time of Christ, world population levels were about 200 million people. In fact, it wasn't until 1830, after William Carey, that the world population reached 1 billion people. And it took another 100 years, 1930, until world population reached 2 billion. But by 1960, it was 3 billion. By 1975, it was 4 billion. Before 1990, it was 5 billion. And we're looking at a world population estimate by the end of the century of 6.3 billion people. This means that a country like Mexico needs to create 15 million new jobs by the end of the century. It means that in a country like Kenya, 50% of all of the citizens of that country are 15 years of age or younger. We are living in an increasingly populous world, and with all the problems that that creates, this is a fact which must be faced in our understanding of the task that God gives us in missions. Not only are we living in a world of exploding population, but a world of increasing economic tension. Part of this tension is brought about by inflation. Now, here in the United States, when we hear the word double-digit inflation, people are terrified. But there are many parts of the world that experience triple-digit inflation annually. 500%, 600%, 700% inflation annually. There are even a few countries in the world which experience quadruple-digit inflation now and then. I remember a few years ago I was in the country of Argentina. At that time, their inflation rate was somewhere between 600 and 700%. I got into a taxi, and I learned to look carefully at the meter. And as we got to the end of where the taxi driver was taking me, I got out, and he asked for a certain amount of money, and I said, "Now, wait a minute." I said, "That's not what the meter says." He said, "Well, I'm basing the amount of money I'm charging you on this," and he pulled out a chart. I said, "What's that?" He said that the inflation rate is so great that we simply can't go through the expense of adjusting the taxi meters. So we only adjust the taxi meters every month, but every week we get a new printout basing what we charge you looking at the meter, then we figure it for the rate of inflation on this chart," and he showed it to me. So inflation is something that impacts you almost daily. Now think of what that means when it comes to building a church building and saving money. The more money you save, the more worthless it gets, so it seems. And so spending quickly rather than saving becomes a virtue, which is totally contrary to the values with which we have been inculcated. Or think of what that means for support levels. When we returned to Costa Rica at the end of 1972, our support level for a family of five was $511 a month. And that was 80% of the cost of living in the United States. When we left Costa Rica, our basic support was $1,473 a month, and the cost of living in Costa Rica was 116% compared to the cost of living in the United States. So you see what inflation does. And certainly in the past 10 years, the inflationary spiral has continued even more and more, raising enormously the cost of missionary support. And this spiraling cost of living produces economic tensions which simply can be exploited into turbulent violence. This kind of economic insecurity creates a lot of tensions. So not only do you have the reality of inflation with which we must contend, but we also have the growing gap between the rich and the poor in the world. it's not necessarily that the rich are getting richer and the poor are getting poorer, but that the rich are getting richer faster than the poor, so that the gap is increasing. And poverty is widespread in many parts of the world. Infrahuman, subhuman poverty. Missionary researchers have begun to bring together the fact that many of the unreached peoples of the world are among the poorest of the poor. And so lostness and poverty seem to go together. And middle-class missionaries haven't had much experience at planting churches among the poor. Just recently, I was with Viv Grigg, who has given his life to planting churches among the poor. And he has as a goal to facilitate the establishment of a church in every slum in the world by the year 2000. He believes that slum dwellers are open to the gospel if people will only go there and work with people who live in the slums of the world. Poverty, for many of us, is a statistic. We may see some clips on television. We may read some stories in the paper. But it's distant from the experience of many of us. It wasn't until I began to understand poverty in terms of people that I began to sense its impact and what it means to say that vast sectors of humankind live in circumstances of poverty. Very early in my missionary career, I was so overwhelmed by the situations of poverty that I had just recently experienced that I sat down at my desk, which at that time consisted of a door laid across two sawhorses, and I wrote out some of the things that I had personally experienced within the past week or month. I decided to define poverty in terms of people. This is what I wrote in my diary. Poverty is a 12-year-old boy with open sores on his legs and elbows and blood on his shirt coming to my house at 5:45 p.m. after having worked all day without having shined a single pair of shoes and offering to shine my shoes for nothing, if only I'll give him something to eat. Poverty is countless naked children with spindly legs and swollen bellies and pathetic faces. Poverty is having four children die from worms and giving away your youngest son because you can't feed him and don't want him to die too. Poverty is having a constant bloody diarrhea because you don't have enough money to buy worm medicine or even to buy firewood to boil your drinking water. Poverty is to be a farmer watching eight calves die with worms hanging out of their rectum to the ground and having no access to a veterinarian and no money to buy medicine for them. Poverty is to have a goiter because iodized salt costs too much to eat. Poverty is seven people living in one room without heat, light, or water for which they pay a fourth of their monthly salary. Poverty is a widow sending her third grade boy out to work in the fields for $2.50 a week and living in a three-sided stick house like the one the wolf blew down in the story of the three little pigs. Poverty is living out your life on a skateboard with your legs tangled like limp spaghetti beneath you, begging on a curb because of the lack of money for medical care when you had polio. Poverty is mentally ill people walking down the street dirty and half-clothed because there's no hospital in which to intern them. Poverty is to have born 17 children and have 12 of them die before they reach adulthood. Poverty is to have all 11 of your children sick at the same time. Poverty is the look on a mother's face when you tell her that two of her children are going to die because no medical care is available. Poverty is the grin of a 10-year-old boy with an untreated cleft palate and hair lip. Poverty is a 5-year-old girl with her feet turned over so that she walks on the side of her ankle, which is covered with a thick callus like the sole of a foot. Poverty is watching skinny, mangy, flea-covered dogs follow behind naked children for the privilege of eating the excrement which drops from their little bodies. Poverty is 80 kids crowded into a school classroom. Poverty is a farmer doing his spring planting with a stick. Poverty is when wages are so low and work so hard to find that it's more profitable to beg. Poverty is dying after 18 hours of trying to expel the placenta with the help of a midwife because you can't afford to call the doctor in the next town 5 miles away. Poverty is eating with an 18-year-old boy who has never had a whole glass of whole milk in his whole life and who stares at me incredulously as I pour a glass of milk for our children, and he says to me, "Don't you put water in your milk too?" That's what poverty is in terms of people. That's what we're talking about when we talk about the relationship between poverty and lostness, the gap between rich and poor. And this is complicated even further by the debt crisis which we're currently experiencing in the world, where a huge percentage of the national income of many two-thirds world's nation goes into simply servicing the debt. The point has come in some nations where they are paying out more money in interest than all of the foreign aid and the foreign exchange that they receive. So that they are, despite their poverty, they're paying out more than they're receiving. This is the crisis this creates in the world, the tension because of the danger of default and what that would do to the world economic situation. And the hardship that is imposed upon people as governments have to take draconian measures of austerity in already poor nations in order to meet the payments on their foreign debt. So the debt crisis is with us. And another dimension of the economic aspect of missions is simply a growing materialism in some part of the world, that third world peoples, two-thirds world peoples are not exempt from materialism. It's a universal human temptation. The Asian Challenge, writing from Asia, an Asian writes, "Today Singapore is in the grips of a materialistic philosophy. The philosophy has affected our outlook on work, perhaps even more than we're aware of. The standard of living is the goal of Singapore today. We have been brainwashed into believing that bigger and better homes, well-paid jobs, and more luxurious gadgets are the only worthy goals in life. The general philosophy seems to be earn more money with less work in the shortest possible time. And more Christians are taking on more and more work in order to earn more and more money for bigger and better things at the cost of less and less time for the Lord and for the church." The economic context of missions today. Let's look at the religious context, the resurgence of non-Christian religions. There are four religions to which I'd like to call your attention very briefly, and each of them, in contrast to the decline and decadence which they were experiencing in the 19th century, have experienced a rejuvenation as they have encountered Christianity and sought to strengthen themselves. And each of them seeks to strengthen themselves and present themselves in the light of perceived weaknesses in Christianity. I think, for instance, of Hinduism. Hinduism presents itself as the religion of tolerance. It challenges the claim of Christianity to uniqueness and supremacy. It challenges the Christian claim about the finality of Jesus Christ. It challenges the claim that he is the only Redeemer, the only way to salvation. Hindus claim that all religions contain an element of the truth. And so the best thing to do is take the truth of all religions and make use of it. And they argue that religion which is narrow-minded and bigoted can lead to strife and division, and that the only way to have one world in which there's peace and understanding is to acknowledge the truth of all religions and adopt the principle of peaceful coexistence. In Hinduism, there's 330,000 gods, and so they're all too willing to accept the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ as one more God to the Hindu pantheon, but they reject the insinuation that Christ is the only way. And this makes an appeal to those Americans for whom Christ is just a name and not a reality. So Hinduism presents itself as the religion of tolerance. Buddhism presents itself as the religion of peace. They claim that Christianity has claimed to bring peace to the world. They point to World War I and World War II and said these wars were fought among nations which claimed to be Christian. And they add, who was it that dropped the one and only or the first atomic bomb on the people of the world. Islam, on the other hand, claims to be the religion of brotherhood. They claim that they're the only group that can unite the people of the world regardless of race or color into one group. They point out that mosques are open to people of all races. No one is excluded from the mosque. And they are quick to point out that nations in which Christianity is predominant have not yet solved the problems of racial prejudice. Marxism, which I consider a rival religion, is in decline today, but nevertheless, it presents a challenge to Christianity. It presents itself as the religion of social justice. It says that religion, often Christian faith, has become the opiate of the people. It has made people insensitive or has given them rationalization or an excuse to ignore the suffering of the humankind or the human race. And so emphasizes social justice. And it has captured a worldwide allegiance, even though that allegiance now seems to be crumbling. As we speak of the various religions of the world, I would like to pay special attention to Islam, because Islam is one of the most potent rivals of Christianity today. Now suppose we were to have an exercise here in which I were to say to you, now draw a picture of a Muslim. Can you think of the picture that you would draw? Most likely you would picture someone in a long flowing robe, kneeling on a prayer rug with a mosque or a minaret in the background. And the implication there is that Islam is the religion of the Arabs. It's kind of confined to the Middle East. And although the Middle East certainly is one of the strong bastions of Islam, we need to recognize that nearly one out of every five persons in the world today is a Muslim. There are at least 40 million Muslims in the Soviet Union. Think of the tension that has caused with a government which is claimed to be atheistic, while Islam has asserted that the unity and the existence of God. Or think of China, where there are 60 million Muslims. Or think of India, where there are 100 million Muslims. So we must be aware of the extensive Muslim presence in the world. In order to understand Islam a little bit more thoroughly, I'd like to point out five changes which have taken place in Islam. Some of the areas of growth and their impact on missions. The first change is the growth in wealth. Think of the gas pump, how the price of gasoline has increased, how oil, which used to cost $2 a barrel, now costs as much as $30 a barrel. And think of what that has meant for the wealth of Muslim states. Islam has always felt itself superior to the West in all but the material realm. But now the new wealth enables Muslim governments to buy the skills or the equipment that they lack. And it provides a financial stockpile for large-scale attempts at mission work into the whole of the non-Muslim world. And so that the oil wealth is financing Muslim evangelism all around the world. There's no separation of church and state, and so money that comes in to Islamic governments is used for the purposes of evangelization, of building mosques and financing mission work throughout the world. And then there's been a growth in commitment, a qualitative growth in commitment to Islam. Islam tried the capitalism of the West and the socialism of the Eastern Bloc, and they found both of them bankrupt. And so now Islam offers a total way of life that seeks to meet mankind's spiritual and material needs. For the non-religious person, Islam provides, first, a coherent culture, second, a just society, and third, a system of government and economics that can satisfy their intellectual needs. And for the people who are particularly religious, Islam offers a rational faith, an uncorrupted book, a final prophet, and the religion of one God. To the self-esteem which Islam has never been lost can be added a renewed confidence that it has the answers. If the Quran isn't clear enough, Qaddafi spells it out. And many university women who once looked to the West for their styles now drape themselves in the traditional garb of Islam under yards and yards of cloth. Not only is Islam growing in wealth and growing in commitment, but it's also growing in numbers. In the Soviet Union, the birth rate is declining, whereas in the last 10 years, Soviet Muslim population increased by 35%. We already spoke of the Muslim population in China at least 60 million, some would say up to 130 million. And so there's a growth in the number of Muslims. And wherever there's social injustice, that conversion rate tends to increase. And then fourth, there's a growth in deliberate, intentional Muslim missions. In fact, in the Columbia paper just a couple of years ago, there was a huge ad that said, "Close your eyes, open your mind. Your God doesn't have contradictions? What about your Bible?" And here were a list of alleged contradictions in the Bible, and followed by, in almost headline type, "If you're looking for the truth, you're looking for Islam." This was an ad in the state newspaper here in Columbia, South Carolina, and then with the information where you could find Muslims who would help you find the truth. So there's been a growth in missions, and a tremendous amount of funds have been poured into this and into the distribution of the Quran. For instance, here I have a copy of the glorious Quran. Its text and an explanatory translation by Muhammad Marmaduke Pickthall. Wonderfully produced hardcover. Here is the Arabic text in one side and the English text of the Quran in another side. Lots of helps, introductions, notes, beautifully bound, high-class paper. How much do you think a Bible of this quality would cost? $20? $30? $35? $39? How much do you think this cost? Didn't cost a penny. They're giving them away. I simply wrote into the address, and they sent me this copy free of charge through one of the Muslim missionary organizations, which was operating out of the United Nations at that time. So there's a growth in missions and a growth in Muslim organizations as well. There are a number of Islamic organizations that have developed an institutional infrastructure. The Islamic Development, I'm not talking just about religious organizations or mission societies, but Muslims are organizing. The Islamic Development Bank, the Islamic Foreign Ministers Conference, the Muslim World League, the World Assembly of Muslim Youth, and there's news bureaus and magazines and educational bodies and professional groups like the Association of Muslim Scientists and Engineers and many other which are seeking to mobilize the Muslim community. In Islam, you don't have a distinction between church and state, between religion and culture. It's one unified whole. And so there's no problem in mobilizing the resources of the entire community for the expansion of Islamic faith. And even in spite of the setback occasioned by the Gulf War, Islam continues to advance, continues to challenge Christianity. Three particular zones of confrontation are what we call the African animistic angle, which stretches from West Africa across the Horn of Africa and then down the East Coast. This contains about 25 million animists who are in the process of making up their mind. They've discovered animism is inadequate, and they're either going to become Christians or they're going to become Muslims. They're in the balance right now. And then we find areas like Indonesia, which is where there's great tension right now as the Muslims seek to convert Indonesia into a Muslim state. And then another area is black persons living under oppressive governments. If the black Muslims in the United States and Muslims in South Africa, which until recently has been experiencing apartheid. In addition to Islam, another great threat has been communism. Now, communism has a great deal in common with Islam. I sometimes refer to communism as the Islam of the technocratic era, because both communism and Islam are vigorous rivals of the Christian faith, but yet they were born within areas where the Christian faith had been accepted for centuries. Secondly, both ideologies were deeply influenced by the Christian scriptures. Third, both ideologies were aided greatly by their birth and early spread by the weaknesses of the current practices of Christianity. And lastly, both of their ideologies exploded into history with a violent eruption of energy. As we look to the communist world, we realize that there have been dramatic changes in recent years. This is because communism has failed to produce. Marxism failed to produce the new man, and Marxism failed to eliminate poverty. And Marxism was attractive because it promised to do these two things. And so we're living in a new period of time when it comes to the relationship of missions to the communist world. We have been examining the context of missions. We've been examining the history of missions since the book of Acts. And we have seen what God has done through the centuries. We have seen how the faith, the Christian faith, has grown and how it has crossed new frontiers until it has become a worldwide faith. As we recognize what God has done in the past, we need to be keenly aware that God is at work today. And despite the challenges that are presented by our context, we need to be aware that ahead of us lie open many doors of opportunity.